Hello and welcome to Volume 45, Number 21 of Grapevine, your weekly local news magazine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District's Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday the 22nd of May 2026. I'm Graham, your presenter, joined this week by Alison and Andrew. And in the news this week, the new local and county councillors are settling in. Once more, the tourist tax rears its ugly head. And an update on what's happening at the Regent. All this plus Grapevine Extra with Alison on the month of May and Andrew on Oak or Blimey. First, though, a grovelling apology on last week's birthdays. Yeah, the first of the news shortly, but first a bit of grovelling from me about last week's birthdays. I missed one. So, sincere apologies to Rex Steadman, a new listener and Grapevine's original chairman, who I'd not put in the diary. Sorry, Rex. I hope that you had a good day on Monday the 18th. OK, it's time for the first part of this week's local news. So, over to Alison and Andrew.
Hello everybody and welcome to Grapevine. Lovely sunny day here ahead of our bank holiday weekend. Andrew with you, and as always, joining me across the studio is Alison. And Alison, you're going to start today for us.
Thank you. Hello everybody. Rupert Lowe and his Great Yarmouth First councillors will back Reform UK's legal challenge to block government plans to scrap and replace all of Norfolk's councils. In a move which could prove significant, given the political makeup at Norfolk County Council, Restore Britain MP Mr Lowe said the nine-strong Great Yarmouth First group would back the prospective Reform UK administration's challenge. Reform UK, which has 40 councillors at County Hall, three shy of a majority, looks likely to run the authority as a minority administration when the authority elects a new leader on May the 28th. That would leave it relying on votes from other parties to enact major policies, and Great Yarmouth First's support to fight local government organisation could prove crucial. Reform UK group leader David Bick announced on Friday, May the 15th, that his party would take legal action to block proposals to get rid of the current eight Norfolk councils, including Norfolk County Council. The Labour government intends to replace them with new unitary authorities, Greater Norwich City Council, East Norfolk Council and West Norfolk Council. Mr Bick said the party could not stand idly by and watch the government dismember our county. Mr Bick acknowledged the legal challenge would come at a cost to taxpayers, but said challenging it would be far cheaper than implementing it. And Great Yarmouth MP Rupert Lowe, leader of Restore Britain, of which the Great Yarmouth First councillors are a local arm, agreed. He said, "Our county councillors will oppose it alongside reform. We fully back the legal challenge and will continue to fight to keep decisions about Norfolk in the hands of local people." John Whedon, leader of the Great Yarmouth First councillors, said, "The people of Norfolk do not want this pointless reorganisation. This legal action is not just about saving tens of millions of pounds. It is about defending the right of local people to run their own affairs." But Kay Mason-Billig, former Conservative leader of the council, said her administration had already started the process to challenge the government. She said, "The decision of the government on local government reorganisation seems irrational, and that needs to be tested. So the Conservative administration at Norfolk County Council had written to the government asking for their reasoning behind the decision. We also put in freedom of information requests and had consulted a KC to look at options for a possible legal challenge. We are awaiting that advice before deciding, but any challenge has to have a firm legal footing or it is a waste of taxpayers' money. The local government reorganisation decision looks to be irrational and based on a political decision. If it is, we should all be opposing it." Under the previous Conservative administration, County Hall had proposed one unitary council and South Norfolk Council wanted two. But the government decided to go with three, as proposed by the other councils, Norwich, Great Yarmouth, West Norfolk, North Norfolk, Breckland and Broadland. Alistair Beales, independent leader of West Norfolk Borough Council, said the challenge was no surprise. He added, "We believe it is important that councils continue to work constructively together in the interests of residents across the county. We believe it is possible to both challenge aspects of the current process while continuing to engage pragmatically and responsibly with partners and government."
And staying at County Hall, the Reform UK administration has also indicated that scrapping net zero policies and initiatives will be among other top priorities once they assume control. The party has taken aim at Norfolk County Council's environmental commitments with its first motion since becoming the authority's biggest political group at this month's elections. The 40-strong group is calling for a review of council spending linked to net zero and a pledge that future climate-related expenditure should demonstrate, quote, measurable benefit and value for money. Reform Councillor Nick Taylor, who represents Helston, said the backdrop to the motion, to be discussed on Thursday, May the 28th, was the authority's near £900 million debt at a time when costs of services such as adult social care and children's services outstrip government funding. He said, "We're suggesting the council cannot afford to be doing things that do not satisfy the council's mandate of providing best value. On net zero, we are proposing a review of all those initiatives to find out the cost benefits of them. One of the biggest schemes which would come under spotlight is the authority's £83 million initiative, agreed under the previous Conservative administration, to make its properties more energy efficient and cut carbon emissions. That project includes changes such as installing heat pumps to some 200 council buildings, such as fire stations, libraries and museums." Mr. Taylor said, "What we should not be doing is removing perfectly serviceable oil and gas heaters just to meet these 2030 net zero targets. They should only be replaced when existing systems have reached the end of their lives." He said a similar approach was needed over the council's vehicle fleet. He said they should be replaced with electrical vehicles only when current diesel or petrol cars can no longer be used, and only then if that is the best value option. "This is not a decision about climate change. For us, climate change is one thing and net zero is another. The term net zero means achieving a balance between carbon emitted into the atmosphere and the carbon which is removed from it by moving away from the use of fossil fuels. In 2019, the UK government set a target requiring the country to bring all greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by 2050. While County Hall had a target to make its estate, including its buildings, net zero by 2030. But continuing, Mr. Taylor said the drive to hit such targets risked deindustrialising and degrading the economy while making no difference to global climate change. His motion calls for all 84 councillors to agree, quote, "This council believes that Norfolk taxpayers expect the County Council to prioritise practical frontline services, value for money and evidence-based decision-making over symbolic or ideological initiatives." John Whedon of the Great Yarmouth First Group, which has nine councillors, confirmed his group will support the motion. But Kay Mason-Billig, leader of the Conservative Group, which saw its numbers cut from 50 to 8 at the ballot box, said, "I stand by this council and my administration's excellent record on the environment, which has been recognised by independent bodies as being real and proportionate." She said the words net and zero did not feature in the authority's environmental policy, which was published in March. "Most of the world, with the exception of Labour's Energy Secretary Ed Miliband, has moved on from any symbolic or ideological initiatives, as they call it," she said. "This council has always taken a responsible and pragmatic approach to the environment, recognising that in a beautiful county like Norfolk, we have a duty to protect and enhance nature. This does not have to come at the expense of progress." She said the motion was blatant politicking and an attempt by Reform to pander to some of their core. Brian Watkins, leader of the 13-strong Liberal Democrat group, said, "It is disappointing that this motion comes from a place where there is scepticism that work being done to protect residents in vulnerable areas is being prioritised through symbolic or ideological initiatives. It minimises the devastating reality seen in places like Hemsby and Haysborough. The 12-strong Green Group said the authority had saved $16 million through net zero initiatives, which has also included switching off streetlights. Helen Visocki, Green County Councillor, said, "Net zero isn't only about the environment. The cost of living crisis is fundamentally linked to our dependence on fossil fuels, and residents feel that every single day when they shop for food, heat their homes or fill up their cars." County Hall, of course, is currently under no political control, but it is anticipated Reform will run the council as a minority administration after next week's full council meeting. At that meeting, Reform's leader, David Bick, is likely to be elected leader and would then form his cabinet, which would formulate council policy.
A developer has revealed plans for a new housing estate of 128 homes in a Norfolk Broads village that could grow by more than a third. Crocus Homes is planning to build the estate on land south of Bosgate Rise in Martham. The company has not yet submitted a planning application, but has begun a public consultation, sending letters about the proposed development to villagers. The new estate would sit on land already allocated for roughly 135 dwellings in Great Yarmouth Borough Council's emerging local plan. The scheme would include 96 homes for open market sale, alongside 32 affordable properties, with a mix of flats and 1 to 4 bedroom houses. The Bosgate Rise plans would add to a village where hundreds of other homes are already in the pipeline. Crocus is currently building 65 affordable homes on nearby Staithe Road, with a topping out ceremony held earlier this year. Broadland Housing Association won approval in September 2024 for a 176-home development south of Reps Road, a scheme that includes a new roundabout to serve the growing western edge of the village. Cripps Developments is also building around 80 homes at the Mallards, north of Reps Road, and plans for a further 46 homes off White Street were approved by councillors in January. The Borough Council has also approved plans for 49 houses at Martham East Broiler Farm, a former chicken hatchery off Acacia Avenue. Taken together, the various developments add up to more than 500 additional homes, a figure that could increase the village's housing stock by roughly a third or more. Previous applications have seen residents warn repeatedly that roads, GP services and school capacity are already under strain. Great Yarmouth Borough Council is expected to adopt its new local plan, which includes Martham as a designated growth village, in early summer 2026.
Now here's an item about a building I'm sure many of you will remember. First it was a grand seaside theatre and a cinema, then a bingo hall, and finally a nightclub. Now, at least one part of the Regent Theatre on Regent Road in Great Yarmouth could reopen to the public as a food bank. The Grade 2 listed building closed in 2016, and that spring was bought for £215,000 by a small London-based church group. Since then, the venue has shown few outward signs of life, and many in the town have assumed it was abandoned. But behind closed doors, the church group Global Miracle Gospel Ministries has been using the theatre for Sunday services, with worshippers travelling from London and from across Norfolk. And earlier this month, the theatre entered the spotlight again after a group of urban explorers made their way into the building and posted a video of their first visit on Facebook. In the footage, they described the theatre as abandoned and left untouched for 10 years. A caretaker at the building has insisted that this is not the case, however, and the Great Yarmouth Mercury was invited to inspect the theatre. The reporter said on the day of the visit, a pair of pigeons flew around inside the echoing auditorium while contractors fitted new security measures, including metal doors, CCTV and alarms, following a series of break-ins. Since its closure 10 years ago, the building had fallen into some disrepair, with water leaking through the roof. And 2022, heritage charity The Theatres Trust placed the building on its at-risk register, warning that it faces ongoing threat from deterioration and lack of use. But in recent years, the owners appear to have been restoring parts of the theatre, including repairing the roof and replacing rotten floorboards. They have also exposed original oak panel walls and floors, built a new floor in the auditorium, installed new air conditioning and a central heating system, and refurbished one of the toilets. Numerous attempts have been made to contact the church group, which is led by a man named Dr. Abraham Daniel Joel. And while they have not responded to the Mercury's inquiries, it is understood they intend to open the old tea room as a food bank, and they have been using the stage and auditorium for their Sunday services. Great Yarmouth Borough Council has told the owner they must apply for a change of use for both the food bank and the church services, but no planning applications have yet been submitted for the theatre. A council spokesperson said, "Great Yarmouth Borough Council welcomes further discussions with the owners of the Regent's Theatre so they can liaise with the council's planning department before committing to a potential change of use of the building and to discuss any possible need for planning permission." The Theatre's Trust said it too had struggled to get a response from the building's owners. The Trust had previously said, following the Regent's inclusion on the Theatres at Risk register, Theatres Trust has been contacted by several groups, all with a focus on community and cultural ambitions, and keen to see whether there may be opportunity for using the building. Sadly, attempts to contact the owner to discuss the opportunities and find a positive solution for the building have been unsuccessful. Global Miracle Gospel Ministries is a small Pentecostal Christian charity based in Upper Edmonton, North London, registered with the Charity Commission for England and Wales. It was formally registered as a charitable trust on April 8, 2016, just 4 days after the Regent Theatre was sold. The group's stated purpose is to advance the Christian faith through gospel proclamation, teaching and training for Christians, and support for the local community through outreach programmes. Global Miracles is a very small charity. For the financial year ended July the 7th, 2024, it reported a total income of £18,972 and a total expenditure of £16,854. Norfolk Police have twice been called to the theatre on Sunday, May the 10th, following reports of young people damaging the building and acting aggressively. Officers secured the site and moved on a group during their second visit. No arrests were made. Police said that the trespass is generally a civil matter, but criminal damage or aggravated trespass can lead to enforcement. And they added that the building owners are responsible for securing their properties.
A controversial bid for nearly 450 homes at the edge of Galston could erode the gap between the town and a neighbouring village, locals say. Hopton-on-Sea Parish Council says it cannot take such a large development and fears Galston will encroach on the village if plans for the huge new estate on Lynx Road are approved. There has already been a lot of house development in Hopton-on-Sea and we feel that the village cannot take such a large development, read the Parish Council's scathing objection to proposals submitted by the County Council-owned Repton Property Developments. We are concerned about the encroachment and loss of green space between Hopton-on-Sea and Galston. The proposed huge 446-home housing estate falls within Hopton, but is deemed an extension of Galston by planners. The Parish Council claims it has been inundated with more than 400 complaints about the application. Locals fear attempts to get appointments at doctors and dentists will be exacerbated by the influx of new homes. The town cannot support this continued level of development and population growth, read one objection. There are not enough facilities provided for health, education and recreation. Rupert Lowe, MP for Great Yarmouth, said infrastructure in the area, including at the James Paget Hospital, 500 metres away, is already under pressure. A 70-bed care home is also included in the plan for the development. According to planning documents, the new homes will be built in four phases, with the care home to be delivered in the final stage. Of the 446 new homes, 67 will be classed as affordable properties. Despite the widespread opposition, councillors at Great Yarmouth Borough Council were expected to approve the proposals at a meeting on Wednesday. Officials have recommended the scheme go ahead because of the need for housing.
Uncertainty still surrounds when people will be able to take a range of electrical items to Norfolk's tips again, following a fire which ripped through a recycling depot. And a fresh plea for people not to throw such devices and batteries in with their rubbish has been made after a bin lorry caught fire in Norwich. As previously reported, the partial ban on electrical items has been in place at Norfolk's recycling centres after Wiser Recycling at Thetford, which Norfolk County Council used to process many of the electrical items that people recycle, was hit by a major fire last month. The company has now stopped operating from its Thetford site after it lost its treatment facility approval. And that has left County Hall with no legal way to deal with much of the electrical waste which people take to its 19 recycling centres. With the company not likely to reopen, the council has had to apply to a national scheme to be appointed with a new contractor and has to wait for that process to conclude. In the meantime, recycling centres can still accept washing machines, tumble dryers, dishwashers and cookers. But other electrical items such as microwaves, televisions or monitors, fridge freezers, laptops, batteries, mobile phones, printer cartridges, light bulbs and other small electrical items cannot be accepted. A spokeswoman for Norfolk County Council said, "We know this is inconvenient and we're sorry for the continued disruption. We are working closely with national regulators to put a safe and legal solution in place so we can bring the service back as quickly as possible." A particular plea has been issued for people not to fly tip such items or to put electrical items in with the normal rubbish, as these can spark fires. On Monday last week, one of Norwich City Council's bin lorries caught fire in Gertrude Road after a power bank containing a lithium battery was thrown away and triggered a blaze. A County Hall spokesman said, "In the meantime, we remind residents to never place electrical items or batteries in household waste bins, as this poses a serious fire risk. People are asked to safely store unwanted electrical items at home until services resume."
Inspectors have given their verdict on the standard of services Norfolk County Council provides to its most vulnerable children and have rated it outstanding in all areas. It marks a massive turnaround in the County Hall department in just over a decade, with the department going from inadequate to the topmost ratings possible. Inspectors from Ofsted visited the council in February to scrutinise areas such as the welfare of children in care, fostering, adoption and child protection. In all five areas inspected, an outstanding rating was given. Inspectors praised the council's child-centred approach, relationships between social workers and children and young people, and the inspirational strategic and operational leadership. They said children in Norfolk receive consistently strong services that impact positively on theirs and their families' lives. It is in striking contrast to inspections in 2013 and 2015 when the department was rated inadequate. Sarah Tuff, Executive Director of Children's Services, appointed in 2017, said, "This report is the culmination of many years of incredible hard work from everyone across Children's Services, and I want to thank staff from across the service for all they're doing to help Norfolk's children to flourish. Staff across the department change children's lives every day, and they deserve this recognition. It means the department is now one of the top performing in the country." Kay Mason-Billig, Conservative leader, said, "This has come about due to the determination of our staff, who have been working as a team, alongside our partners and key stakeholders. Sarah Tuff has worked tirelessly. My administration has given her our full political support, so she could have the confidence and flexibility to reorganise her department. This has not been easy, with the increasing demand on services and the ever-constrained budgets. However, we recognise that the children of our county deserve the very best, and we have delivered that."
Now, here's a follow-up on a story we featured a good few weeks ago about a terrifying accident abroad that has left a woman facing a medical bill of £60,000. Joanna Ingram from Belton broke her back in three places after falling from a horse during the final days of a holiday in Thailand on March the 8th. Joanna said she still has no memory of her fall, which left her fearing she might never walk again. "One minute I was on the back of the horse, the next I was lying on my back on the ground," she said, "and I've got no recollection of how I got there." She was rushed into an emergency spinal surgery, which doctors said was necessary to stabilise her spine and reduce pain. Mrs. Ingram explained, "I went into emergency surgery and thankfully I do have full movement, which is an absolute miracle." However, the couple's insurance provider did not cover the cost of her treatment, stating that horse riding was classed as high-risk activity. This meant she racked up a £60,000 medical bill, draining the couple's life savings. After spending 3 weeks in hospital, she moved to a hotel to recover until she was fit to travel. But further complications arose when she contracted dengue fever, an infection spread by mosquitoes, with symptoms including high temperature, severe headache and swollen glands. She said she'd never felt so ill and was worried about whether she would pull through. But after a total of 11 weeks, she was able to fly home. With the help of a GoFundMe page set up by friends and family, £19,000 has been raised towards the cause. "We can't believe the generosity of the people that have contributed," she added. "I can't describe how it felt to finally be going home. There was so much relief and excitement at finally being able to see my family and friends again."
A Norfolk man has participated in a trailblazing drug trial to combat a sight-threatening disease. Dermot, aged 72, who receives care at the James Paget Hospital in Galston, is the first person in the UK and Europe to take part in the Phoenix drug trial. The trial, which has enrolled more than 500 patients globally, is part of a study which aims to determine the effectiveness of a drug called Tinlarebant in slowing the progression of geographic atrophy, or GA. Dermot, who lives near King's Lynn, said, "It's a serious condition affecting mainly older people. There's no cure, and as it progresses, you lose your central vision, so that eventually it means you're unable to read, drive or see faces, although your peripheral vision remains unaffected." GA is an advanced form of dry age-related macular degeneration, or AMD, and a potentially serious and progressive eye condition that affects the back of the eye. He first realised he had an issue with his sight in the summer of 2021, when he noticed a type of flashing in front of his eyes. A trip to the optician, followed before a referral for tests, led to a diagnosis of AMD, which affects more than 500,000 people in the UK. Ben Burton, a consultant professor at the James Paget and leading authority on AMD, recruited Dermot onto the Phoenix trial in 2024. Dermot has now completed his 2 years on the study, which has involved him taking a tablet once a day and regularly visiting the research team at the Paget. Dermot added, "I would encourage anyone who is given the opportunity to participate in research to take it. If trials don't take place and aren't given the chance to succeed, then the disease just carries on. That's why trials like Phoenix are so important and give you the chance to make a positive and important contribution to a disease being slowed or even stopped."
Tributes have been paid to a Norfolk cricket legend who has been described as a unique and wonderful man. Mick Pud Ward joined Acle Cricket Club in the 1950s when he was a 17-year-old and played for 40 years, scoring numerous centuries over that time, including a high mark of 135 not out against Ashmanhow in 1973. After finishing his first team career, he played with and captained the second team. Retirement from playing, though, saw Mr. Ward continue to support the club, including becoming landlord to a number of players from Australia, New Zealand and South Africa who came to spend the summer with the Acle Club. Away from cricket, Pud was known for his work picking litter in the village and cleaning the toilet block and a bus stop. Acle Cricket Club said, "It's impossible to write about Pud because whatever you say will not be enough to do justice to a unique and wonderful man. A man who was so loved by everyone at the cricket club and the village community and beyond. At the moment, it's impossible to imagine Saturdays in the summer without Pud, but I'm sure he'll be keeping an eye on us and toasting our wins with a pint of wherry and a whisky." And the club sent their love and thoughts to Mr. Ward's family. On Saturday, May the 9th, ahead of their fixtures that day, the club observed a minute's silence in his memory. "Rest well, Pud. You will be incredibly missed by everyone at the club and in the village, and we're all very grateful that our world had you in it. "You are an Acle Cricket Club icon and legend," they said. The All About Acle Facebook page said the village had lost a true legend. Mick Pud Ward has been an inspiration for many generations of locals and will be sadly missed by all that knew him, they said. He loved having a pride in his work and he was proud to call Acle his home. Certainly was. I'm pleased to say I've spent a few hours in that man's company and he really was a wonderful chap. And his funeral next Friday, the 29th, is going to be a massive affair. But there will be a smile with it because I'm sure very many of his legendary tales will be retold over a pint or two of wherry. Rest in peace, Pud.
Great Yarmouth has been revealed as one of the most affordable places to buy a first home. The title came from new research by Lloyds, which examined average house prices for first-time buyers across the UK. The average price for a starter home in Great Yarmouth is £236,447, according to the findings, making it the most accessible location for new homeowners in the region. The only place that is on average cheaper than Great Yarmouth is Bolsover, in the East Midlands, where the average first home costs £191,564. Lloyds also reveals the regions with the youngest average first-time buyers. North Norfolk came in sixth place with an average first-time buyer age of 28.4, compared to the national average of 32. Other areas with a low average first-time buyer age include South Staffordshire, Pendle and Cannock Chase. Amanda Bryden, head of mortgages at Lloyds Bank, said, "Our research shows there are still genuine pockets of value for first-time buyers, particularly for those with an open mind who are willing to be flexible on location and property type. With ongoing cost of living pressures and wider economic uncertainty, it's completely understandable that some people are feeling cautious. But there are opportunities out there, and for many buyers, that flexibility can make a real difference."
Well, we have much more full fat news in a nonce after Alison and Andrew have given us some news in brief.
A youth football team has secured sponsorship for a new training jacket for the upcoming season. Denbury Homes is backing the under-13 team at Shrublands Football Club, a grassroots club with around 200 junior members. The club fields mixed youth teams from under-7s to under-15s and also runs men's teams, a women's team and a veterans team. The club also offers a mini Shrubs soccer school for children aged 3 to 5. Monty Beaton, head of sales and marketing at Denbury Homes, said, "We are delighted to support Shrublands FC by sponsoring the youth team's new warm-up kit. Grassroots clubs like Shrublands play a vital role in bringing communities together." Denbury Homes launched the Trinity Rise development in Ormsby St Margaret earlier this year. Aldi is asking shoppers to help choose new store locations in Norfolk. The supermarket chain is inviting people to suggest towns and areas where they would like to see a new Aldi open as part of its over £370 million investment in new stores planned for this year. Jonathan Neal, Managing Director of National Real Estate at Aldi UK, said, "We know how important it is for people to have access to affordable, high-quality food close to where they live, which is why we're asking our shoppers to help us identify the communities that would benefit most from a new Aldi store. Opening new stores in these areas means we can get great value to more customers, while also creating jobs and offering industry-leading pay." Aldi aims to expand to 1,500 stores across the UK and will review the most requested locations as part of its ongoing growth plans. Shoppers can submit their suggestions by emailing nextnewstore, all one word, at aldi.co.uk with their chosen town and the subject line. Submissions will be accepted until June the 18th, 2026. A new block of commercial units could be built at a local industrial park. The scheme would see the construction of 16 new units, which could be used for offices, research or light industrial, off Mallory Road at Beacon Park in Goulston. A decision on the application, in the hands of planners at Great Yarmouth Borough Council, is expected by June the 5th. Supporting papers state that property management company Accord AM Limited is considering buying the site, subject to a successful approval of the plans. Two drivers caught racing down a newly dualled stretch of Norfolk's busiest road have been stopped by police. The speedsters were caught rocketing down the new, fully dualled section of the A47 between Blowfield and North Burlingham on Saturday at 5:30 a.m. and 7:36 a.m. respectively. The first driver was clocked travelling at a staggering 108 miles per hour, whereas the second was recorded driving at 88 miles per hour. Both drivers were pulled over by officers and have since been reported for the offence. The newly dual-laned section of the road has a 70-mile-per-hour limit.
St Nicholas Priory CEVA Primary School and Nursery in Great Yarmouth has achieved another 5-star food hygiene rating. The inspection was unannounced, but the school's kitchen and catering team maintained exceptional standards of cleanliness, food preparation and safety. School leaders expressed gratitude to the catering staff, acknowledging their vital role in enhancing pupils' well-being and creating a safe environment. The school community has also applauded the team's achievement, recognising their significant contribution to school life. A suspected drug dealer caught with thousands of pounds in cash at a seaside guest house has been warned he faces 7 years in prison if convicted. Jake Del Consol, aged 23, was arrested after a search in Great Yarmouth uncovered 170 street-dealing-style wraps of heroin and cocaine, along with a large stash of cash. Appearing before Norwich Magistrates Court via video link from prison, Del Consol of Rushton in Northamptonshire did not enter pleas to charges of possession of Class A drugs with intent to supply. His case was committed to Norwich Crown Court with a plea and a trial preparation hearing set for June the 16th. He was remanded in custody until that date after his defence solicitor said he was not seeking bail. And police investigations are continuing after a teenage boy was punched and robbed of his electric scooter in Great Yarmouth. The robbery happened on Fuller's Hill at 7:30 p.m. on March the 19th, when a man in his 20s approached the teenager, punched him and stole the e-scooter. The boy suffered facial injuries and was taken to hospital for checks. A police spokesman said, "The investigation remains ongoing. No arrests have been made as of yet." A lifeboat was tasked after a small fishing boat sent out an urgency call. RNLI volunteers, who were out on a training exercise on Sunday, heard the call over the VHF radio from the boat. It was drifting in a busy shipping lane after losing engine power near Scroby Sands, just off Scrappy. The vessel was within sight of the lifeboat crew and the Coast Guard was notified of their proximity to the scene. Due to operational restrictions, the crew returned their new Shannon-class lifeboat to its berth and relaunched in their Trent-class lifeboat, Summer Beta. Once back on the scene, the crew assessed the situation and due to the close vicinity of Scroby Sand and being without power in a shipping lane, the safest course of action was to tow the vessel to the nearest safe haven, an RNLI spokesman said. The fishing boat was towed safely to Lowestoft, its home port, and the nearest safe haven. It was met by a Coast Guard rescue team, and the lifeboat crew was stood down and returned to the station.
Don't forget Grapevine Extra coming up with Alison on the month of May and Andrew with some rhyming slang. That's after the rest of this week's news, which is with you at this very moment.
A major police hunt is underway after two teenage girls were raped in Great Yarmouth. Officers were called to South Beach Parade towards the Outer Harbour at 12:37 a.m. on Saturday. A suspect is still at large and police say significant efforts are underway to identify and locate him. He has been described as a white man with short dark hair, dark facial hair and aged in his 30s or 40s. The man was wearing blue jeans and a dark green jacket with a white stripe on both sleeves. Chief Inspector Nick Paling, District Commander for Great Yarmouth, said, "We recognise how shocking and distressing these incidents are for the victims, their families and the wider community. Specialist officers have been deployed to support both girls as we work through this investigation. There will be an increased police presence in the area with officers carrying out reassurance patrols. Please do approach them if you have any concerns or any information. Michael Giel, Borough Councillor of Nelson Ward, had not heard about the incident but said, "Whoever it was, I hope they catch them and I hope they get the heaviest sentence possible." Officers would like to speak to anyone who may have witnessed the incident or who has any relevant information to aid with his investigation.
A fight between twin brothers at a seaside attraction led to one attacking the other with a plank of wood. Bradley Wilson, aged 32, pleaded guilty to causing actual bodily harm after his brother Brett was left with serious head injuries. Police were called to the Britannia Pier in Great Yarmouth on May the 14th, following reports of a fight between men who had been drinking. CCTV footage captured the two brothers exchanging punches in a row over a broken phone. Norwich Magistrates Court was told Brett had been repeatedly kicked while on the floor before his brother hit him several times with a wooden plank. Bradley Wilson, of no fixed abode, admitted assault occasioning ABH and possession of an offensive weapon. He was given bail with conditions to report to police twice a week until he is sentenced on July the 6th. Michael Cole, mitigating, said, "When sober, they are best buddies, but when drinking, they fight. The simple answer would be to stop drinking, but sometimes the simple answer is the most difficult." Brett Wilson was fined £40 and ordered to pay compensation after also admitting two shop thefts in Cambridge.
And a man has appeared in court accused of kicking pigs and hitting them with a pitchfork at a Norfolk farm. Stephen Woolger has been charged with repeatedly striking the animals with a pitchfork and a plastic pipe and failing to protect them from pain, suffering and injury. The charges to relate to when he was at the Innovis Gene Transfer Centre, known as GTC, a boar semen farm in Borough Castle between May and September 2024. Mr. Woolger, of no fixed address, appeared at Great Yarmouth Magistrate Court only to confirm his name and address. Dewey Jones, the CEO of Innovis Limited, and Nigel Walpole, the farm manager, have also been charged with failing to prevent the causing of unnecessary suffering to an animal as a responsible person. The charges come after hundreds of hours of secret filming by the Animal Justice Project. No pleas have been entered at this stage, and the case has been adjourned for a case management hearing, which will take place on June the 16th at Norwich Magistrates Court.
A reveller who had petrol thrown over him by a man who was refused entry to a house party chased after and attacked him on the street in broad daylight, a court has heard. Carl Pammon had been drinking and socialising with others at a party in a house in Middlemarket Road, Great Yarmouth. Norwich Crown Court heard that Paul Courtney, aged 42, who was not known to the group, turned up but was refused entry to the address. Richard Patterson, prosecuting, said Courtney later returned with a jerry can full of petrol. He said Courtney forced entry into the property and poured petrol inside, including over some of the partygoers, who he then threatened to set on fire before he fled with the petrol can. Courtney, whose actions caused fear and panic, was then pursued by Pammon, who caught up with him on Regent Road in the town. He got more petrol thrown over him before Pammon then delivered 10 to 13 punches to Courtney before stamping and kicking his head. Mr. Patterson said the attack, which happened at about 6 a.m. on May the 27th, 2024, in front of other people at a bus stop, lasted about 30 seconds. Courtney suffered serious but not life-threatening injuries, including head trauma, a broken nose, a partial collapse of both lungs, a fractured wrist and significant blood loss. The defendant, previously of the street, Lowestoft, was given an extended 9-year sentence, made up of 6 years custody and 3 years on licence. The sentence, imposed in December last year, came after he admitted attempted arson, being reckless as to whether life would be endangered. Pammon, of Albion Road, Great Yarmouth, appeared at court on Wednesday, May the 20th, having previously admitted causing actual bodily harm. Recorder Lorna Skinner said Pammon's actions went beyond anything that could be considered lawful self-defence. But taking into account his guilty plea and lack of offending since this incident, Pammon was given 14 months imprisonment, suspended for 18 months. Rob Pollington, mitigating, conceded Pammon had an appalling record, but had remained offence-free since this incident, adding he wants to be a better individual. Mr Pollington said the actions of Courtney were highly dangerous and attracted a 9-year sentence, adding Pammon had accepted that he had crossed a line with the incident starting out with a level of provocation. He said Pammon was a product of the care system and had problems in his youth, including with substance misuse. He was given a 40-day alcohol abstinence monitoring requirement, as well as 10 days rehabilitation activity requirement. He must also undertake 100 hours unpaid work.
Trading standards officers in Norfolk are being abused by shop owners while carrying out their work, say council bosses. The admission comes after the BBC showcased the violent threats being levelled at officers across the country. A survey of enforcement officers found that more than 70% of officers who work for local authorities in England, Wales and Scotland, and more centrally in Northern Ireland, have faced threats of intimidation or violence. Norfolk's officers are no different, a spokesman for the County Council said. Sadly, our trading standards officers would recognise the environment described in the recent BBC report from their own experience working in Norfolk. Officers have encountered non-cooperation and, on occasion, resistance and intimidatory behaviour during inspections, particularly where illicit goods such as illegal tobacco and vapes are involved, he said. While this isn't the full picture, and many business owners and employees work with our staff with professionalism and courtesy, our officers always deserve to be safe from abuse while at work, and we work closely with Norfolk Constabulary to ensure our officers are properly supported and protected in carrying out their duties.
A moat is supposed to protect a castle, not quietly nibble away at a church. But at St Mary the Virgin in Hemsby, years of failed underground drainage have left the medieval building sitting in what locals jokingly call its accidental moat. After heavy rain, water gathers in a ring around the church, soaking into the nave walls and damaging both the exterior stonework and the internal finishes. Now, thanks to a grant from the National Lottery Heritage Fund, the church is finally set to drain its unwanted water feature. Elspeth Moore, who has been helping steer the project, said the situation had become impossible to ignore. When it rains, we end up with a moat around the church, she said. The water just stands there and it's been damaging the building. We've been fundraising for a long time and now we've got the grants to put it right. The National Lottery Heritage Fund has awarded £37,126, forming the final piece of a funding jigsaw that also includes support from the Norfolk Churches Trust, Geoffrey Watling Charity and the Paul Basham Charitable Trust, among others. The full project cost is £70,860. Work is due to begin in July and will involve installing new drainage to carry rainwater safely away from the building, repairing damaged walls and refreshing the church's guidebook with new photographs. The church, which also plans to share more of its heritage online, dates from the early 14th century and was substantially rebuilt in the 1860s, before being restored again in the 1970s. Ms Moore said she hopes the project will help other small parishes facing similar problems. There are lots of churches in the same boat, she said, or, in the case of St Mary the Virgin, the same moat.
A businessman from Texas has opened a new estate agency that promises to deliver a white glove service. Morgan Hubbard has launched Hubbard Homes, which is based in Upper Cliff Road, Galston. The American wants to bring a white glove service, genuine transparency and an agent who picks up the phone to an industry he says has a bad reputation. When I moved to the UK, I was genuinely shocked, he said. Back in Texas, real estate is treated with the gravity it deserves. Agents are trained, professional and deeply accountable. The biggest difference is that we treat every sale as if it were our own home, because we know exactly how much is riding on it. Here I found myself, like almost everyone I spoke to, having a miserable time with people who didn't seem to care. I kept thinking, someone needs to fix this. Mr. Hubbard lives locally and says he is personally involved in every client relationship at Hubbard Homes. And the businessman added, "People often tell me they dread dealing with estate agents. Well, my job is to make sure that by the end of working with us, they can't imagine what they were worried about."
The prospect of the region's first ever mayor being able to levy a tourist tax on visitors staying in Norfolk overnight has been criticised. James Wilde, Conservative MP for North West Norfolk, said the Labour government's plan, which was included in last week's King's speech, would hit people in the pocket and damage the county's tourism industry. The overnight visitor levy bill would give mayors the power to impose a charge on visitors staying in accommodations such as hotels, bed and breakfasts, guest houses and holiday lets. The government said the measure would be used to fund local projects and would bring England into line with Scotland and Wales, as well as several other European countries. Precise details have yet to be unveiled, but Mr. Wilde said it could mean extra charges of £2 per person per night, which could make longer stays in Norfolk unaffordable for some families, harming the tourist economy. Mr. Wilde said families across the country save throughout the year for a well-earned break. Labour's holiday tax would make that trip to the seaside or countryside more expensive and put them further out of reach for many. "Our tourism sector is already struggling to cope with Labour's higher taxes and costs and needs support to encourage more visitors, not new taxes that could deter people coming to enjoy all Norfolk has to offer." Hospitality industry body UK Hospitality claimed that the policy is wildly unpopular and warned that it could add £100 to the cost of a two-week family holiday. It would be mayors who would have the power to use the levy to generate money for other schemes. Norfolk and Suffolk were due to elect their first mayor for the two counties this month, but that election was postponed and will now not take place until May 2028.
A devoted father found dead just days before he was due to start a new job feared he could not provide for his children as Christmas approached, an inquest has heard. The body of Marcus Holmes was discovered on December the 7th last year, having died at the home of a friend in South Quay, Great Yarmouth. The 37-year-old had been allowed to stay temporarily while he tried to get his life back together, but was declared dead by emergency services after he was found hanging there. Norfolk Coroner's Court heard he had been preparing to begin new employment at a chicken farm just days before his death. But an emotional testimony from his mother, Dawn Kerrison, revealed her son had become so low about his inability to give his children a stable home life that he sought her permission to end his life. "He just wanted somewhere he could call home where his children could come and stay," she said. "He was let down." The inquest heard Mr. Holmes had struggled with unstable housing and periods of homelessness. While Miss Kerrison said his greatest wish was simply to have a proper home where he could spend meaningful time with his offspring. And as Christmas drew closer, he became increasingly distressed at the thought of not being able to buy presents for them or provide the kind of festive experience he believed they deserved. Miss Kerrison said her son felt he was failing as a father because he could not offer stability. Despite those struggles, the court heard there had also been signs of hope emerging in the weeks before his death. This included him securing work at a chicken farm, a job he'd been due to start in mid-December. Family members believed the role could have marked an important turning point, but behind the scenes he remained deeply troubled by his circumstances. The court heard he confided in his mother about how hopeless he felt and asked for her permission to end his life, something she desperately tried to talk him out of. She told the court he was a loving son, brother and devoted father who worked hard, cared deeply about his children and had been excited about the prospect of returning to employment. Assistant Coroner Robert Whale concluded Mr. Holmes died by suicide, with a post-mortem confirming his medical cause of death was by hanging. Toxicology tests also revealed high levels of cocaine in his blood at the time of his death. Mr. Whale said its presence suggested the drug had been taken shortly before he died and could have increased impulsive and risk-based behaviour. He added there was clear evidence Mr. Holmes had intended to take his own life and said the combination of emotional distress, housing instability and drug use had contributed to the tragedy. The coroner offered his condolences to Mr. Holmes's family.
Two people and three cats were rescued after their boat ran aground on mud. At around 3 p.m. on May the 8th, the Great Yarmouth and Gorleston lifeboat team was called to Breydon Water following reports of a stranded vessel. A coolant hose had come loose, causing the boat to drift out of the channel and become stuck on the mud. One of the occupants had already tried to free the boat by entering the water, but was unsuccessful. Broads Authority rangers were on the scene, but were unable to get close enough to help due to the depth of the water. The RNLI crew approached within 3 metres of the vessel before deciding it was too shallow to get any closer. They confirmed both people and the cats were safe. Given the falling tide, lack of provisions on board, the unsuccessful attempt to refloat the boat, and concerns about how it might settle as the tide went out, the crew decided on a tow was the safest option. The inshore lifeboat crew secured a line and gradually pulled the vessel free from the mud. Once back in the main channel, the boat was brought alongside the lifeboat for further checks. After restarting the engine and confirming everything was in working order, the lifeboat crew escorted the vessel under its own power to Great Yarmouth Yacht Station. Broads Authority rangers and Coast Guard rescue teams met the boat and crew at the yacht station. The lifeboat team advised the occupants to wear flotation devices and not to enter the water during similar incidents. The inshore lifeboat was then stood down with thanks.
And staying on the Broads, chemicals in pet flea treatments are causing severe and potentially irreversible harm to rivers and wildlife across Norfolk. An assessment by ecologist Matt Shardlow warns the toxic chemicals are widespread in rivers, estuaries and lakes. His review said the chemicals, banned from use as commercial pesticides, are highly toxic to aquatic life and are likely to be hitting bird populations that rely on insects for food, as well as reducing pollinators such as bees in public parks. He pointed to the Norfolk Broads, where all the main rivers entering the park are heavily contaminated with flea treatment toxins, and there are concerns about a 90% decline in dragonfly numbers on the Bure site of special scientific interest. Mr. Shardlow, who's the founding chief executive of wildlife charity Buglife, said, "Across Britain, our rivers, public parks, national parks, and most special wildlife sites are being damaged, potentially irreparably, by exceedingly high levels of toxic insect nerve agents. Flea and tick treatments, which are commonly used on the nation's millions of dogs and cats, are said to be the main route that chemicals such as fipronil and imidacloprid follow to pollute the environment. The treatments enter the environment through the sewage system from washing treated animals or washing of owners of clothing and bedding that the chemicals have rubbed off on. They can also get into the environment when dogs go swimming in water or when pets rub against vegetation which are rained on. It comes after Dereham Town Council urged dog owners to avoid letting their pets swim in local ponds or rivers due to the contamination. Efforts to stop the chemicals getting into the environment by improving sewage plants would be slow and expensive, while measures to prevent pets swimming or being petted for months after application would be highly popular or ignored," said Mr. Shardlow. He said the only sensible option would be for the government's Veterinary Medicines Directorate to review, suspend and ban the flea treatments containing those two chemicals.
A seal pup who made headlines after turning up on a doorstep has been returned to the wild. The grey seal, named Cold Call, was found in Gorleston by postman Glenn Palmer and rescued by Dan Goldsmith of Marine and Wildlife Rescue. The animal was then taken to the RSPCA East Winch Wildlife Centre to be looked after. After 5 months of rehabilitation, she was released back to the sea at a North Norfolk beach, along with 7 other seals. Evangelos Achilios, centre manager at RSPCA East Winch, said, "Nothing ever beats that feeling of being able to release an animal back to the wild, where they belong. Everyone was just stunned she had been found in such an unusual location. Seals require a huge amount of care while at the centre, and one of the biggest challenges is getting them to eat for themselves unaided. The road to recovery is always long, and Cold Call has been with us for 5 months." Mr. Palmer, who discovered the pup, said, "I'm so happy to hear Cold Call has been released. I was gutted not to be there, but I have a feeling of pride of being part of her journey after finding her on the doorstep back in January. The real heroes are the staff at East Winch, as their hard work and expertise is second to none. Mr. Goldsmith, who transported the seal to safety, also attended the release. He said it was wonderful to be there to watch her released back to sea with the other seals. Rescue work is incredibly hard, but it's moments like these that are so rewarding.
A new free exhibition celebrating Great Yarmouth's heritage, from traditional herring smoking to the life of renowned potter and artist Ernie Childs, will open to the public. The old smokehouses on Blackfriars Road, formerly home to the Great Yarmouth Potteries for 45 years, will welcome visitors from May the 27th to the 31st, with doors open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. daily. The exhibition will pay special tribute to Mr. Childs, whose lifelong work championed the town's maritime and cultural history. One of the highlights will be the rare opportunity to step inside the original smoke chambers, a reminder of the town's once thriving herring industry. The event also marks the launch of a new exhibition space, run by Mr. Childs' wife Karen, in one of the former Great Yarmouth Potteries buildings, where the work of local artists will be displayed. Children can take part in a free heritage quiz designed to help younger visitors discover the stories behind the smokehouses, the potteries, and Ernie Childs' contribution to preserving the town's past. Ernie, who died in 2019, aged 72, was known not only for his pottery, but also as a painter, sculptor, and maritime historian, and a very, very nice man too.
A former fish market vendor has leapt at a new opportunity and taken over a seafood restaurant. Jordan Abel, aged 34, is the new owner and manager at the White Swan on North Quay in Great Yarmouth. The wet fish shop and restaurant was originally established by Paul Williams, a local fisherman and fishmonger, in 2019 in the former Riverside pub of the same name. Mr. Abel, who's from Caister, said, "I've worked at Lowestoft Fish Market for 15 years, and Paul was a customer of mine. I approached him and said when he was looking to finish, I'd be happy to buy the place from him. I think it's a fantastic opportunity. I love the sector, both the wet fish shop and the restaurant. I think they're amazing. I love fish. It runs through my veins," he added. Mr. Abel said he's not planning to make any changes to the business. "It's an amazing place, as it is. Why fix what's not broken?" The White Swan's building has a very long history at North Quay, dating back to the early 1700s as a public house, before being officially listed as licensed premises by 1817. It was once popular with bikers, who would pull up to the pub to enjoy a pint. In 2019, the venue reopened as a fishmonger and restaurant when Mr. Williams and Bridget Lowe moved their business from Northgate Street. Previous offerings at the White Swan have included smoked cod, a whole-grain mustard scotch egg, pan-fried halibut, and Malaysian king prawn coconut curry. According to company's house records, Mr. Abel was appointed director of White Swan Fish and Seafood Limited on November the 17th last year and holds 75% or more of the voting rights in the company.
A long-hidden steam engine is set to make a rare public appearance. The late 19th century Burrell engine, with ties to East Anglia, will be a star attraction at the Strumpshaw Museum Steam and Vintage Gathering, taking place this Sunday, May the 24th and Monday, May the 25th. Once out of action for 30 years, the engine has recently been fully restored to working condition and will appear alongside 20 full-size steam vehicles and 18 miniature engines. Visitors will only discover the engine's true identity at the event. The weekend also includes a tractor road run on Saturday, May the 23rd, covering 23 miles through the villages of Reedham, Limpenow, Lingwood, Acle, Wickhampton and Moulton. And the route ends with a barbecue at the Shoulder of Mutton pub in Strumpshaw. Both events are fundraisers for the Strumpshaw Steam Museum, home to one of the UK's largest private steam collections. They replaced the long-running Strumpshaw Steam Rally, which ended in 2025 due to rising costs, increased administration and constraints on the amount of land available for the event. And despite the challenges, organisers remain committing to keeping steam heritage alive. Visitors on Sunday and Monday will also receive free entry to the museum, which includes one of the UK's largest private collections of steam engines. The event will also feature 32 vintage tractors, 15 classic cars and 10 military vehicles. A licensed bar, cafe, traditional fairground rides, trade stands and catering outlets will be available, and the entry is £10 for adult with free admission for the under 16s. And tractor owners can join Saturday's road run by paying on the day. The entry fee is £10 per driver and tractor, plus £5 per passenger. Sounds fun.
The chief executive of the Broads Authority has retired after 25 years at the helm, saying his time in the role has been marvellous. John Packman, who announced his intention to stand down last summer, attended his final meeting earlier this month. He told those present, "This has always been a partnership for me, a partnership with members. I have also been extremely lucky with the chairs that I've had. Being a chief executive can be a very lonely place at times, and having a good relationship with your chair is fundamental to success. It has been a marvellous 25 years. Thank you for the opportunities." His tenure has been characterised by major changes and also frequent tensions at the authority between the sometimes competing interests of those who want it to focus primarily on its national park responsibilities, known as the Parkies, and those more concerned with its navigational duties, or the Navvies. One of the growing themes of his time at the authority has been the impact of climate change on the Broads. He believes the issue will be one of the biggest challenges facing Sarah Cowley, who will replace him at the beginning of August. "We cannot stop these changes happening," he said in an interview in November. "It is about how you adapt to it and manage the rate of change and mitigate the impact on the Broads system. Climate change is already biting hard." Emma Krell, Director of Resources at the BA, will take up the post temporarily until Ms Cowley, a former diplomat, joins the authority. Harry Blathwaite, Chairman of the BA, said, "I would like to thank John for his pragmatism and for getting us to good decisions for the good of the authority."
A new tenant panel is being formed to help shape the future of council housing. Great Yarmouth Borough Council has announced plans for a new tenant engagement panel, which will give residents a direct seat at the table in influencing housing decisions and raising service standards across its stock of more than 5,000 homes. The council is one of only two in Norfolk to retain council housing and aims to put tenants at the heart of its operations. Councillor Graham Plant, portfolio holder for operational property and asset management, said, "Our teams work really hard to provide the best homes and services they can for people. However, we know it is the tenants themselves who are best placed to tell us what works well and what we can do better. We want residents to be at the heart of how their homes are managed and how services operate." The council is seeking 12 tenants to form the panel, which will meet with council officers at least four times a year to identify priorities, raise concerns and suggest improvements. Panel members will have the power to review policies, monitor performance and recommend changes on issues ranging from antisocial behaviour to housing complaints and environmental concerns. Mr Plant added, "The panel is designed to help shape solutions with the council to improve the quality of life for all our tenants right across the borough. This unique opportunity for 12 enthusiastic local people to work with us to help provide the best homes possible. There will be support and training available, and membership of the panel is open to anyone who is a Great Yarmouth Borough Council tenant or leaseholder. The initiative supports new government guidelines under the Consumer Standards Regulations, which call for greater tenant involvement and accountability in social housing. To find out more or register interest, call the Social Housing Team on 01493 846660 or email, all one word here, residentengagement@great-yarmouth.gov.uk.
Slimming World members in Stalham and Scratby collected 181 bags of clothing as part of the Big Slimming World Clothes Throw, raising more than £6,000 for Cancer Research UK. The donations came from members who have slimmed into smaller sizes and wanted to give back to a good cause. Dina Ball, Stalham's Slimming World consultant, said, "It's always a pleasure to see the excitement in the group when the Big Slimming World Clothes Throw comes around. When you're losing weight, it can be easy to focus on the number on the scales, without realising how many non-scale victories are happening in the background, like our changing dress sizes and body shapes. This event celebrates those victories as it is all about members donating their old wardrobe while raising money for an important cause. The annual campaign sees Slimming World members across the UK donate clothes, shoes and accessories they no longer fit into, all in support of Cancer Research UK shops. As well as raising funds, the campaign raises awareness of the link between obesity and cancer. Ms. Ball said, "Being overweight doesn't necessarily mean that a person will develop cancer, but we know that losing weight and maintaining a healthy weight can help prevent a number of health conditions, including some types of cancer." Slimming World has raised more than £30 million for Cancer Research UK to date through various campaigns.
Well, that's all the week's news, so welcome to Grapevine Extra. No typewriter stories this week for a change. Instead, after a quick bit of Vision Norfolk news, we have Cockneys and Maydays. Well, here's an interesting item from Market Vision Norfolk, who says, "Come and enjoy a 20-minute flight in a light aircraft with a pilot," he assures us. "This flying experience is on Wednesday the 24th of June and, whilst free, has a restricted number of places. Transport will leave the Bradbury Activity Centre at 9:30 a.m, returning around 3 p.m. Bring a packed lunch, although drinks are provided. And to book, call Mark or Helen on 01603 573000 or email mark.smith@visionnorfolk.org.uk. That's 01603 573000 or email mark.smith@visionnorfolk.org.uk. Now, the event is obviously weather dependent, and with the restricted spaces, names will be selected at random. Okay, across to Alison, who's taking a look at the month of May, followed closely by Andrew with the Cockneys.
Already, we're over two-thirds through the month of May, a month which has some interesting facts and old superstitions connected to it. May is a month of bank holidays. The last Monday of May is, as we know, spring bank holiday. It's often seen as an unofficial beginning of the season in seaside towns, with the tourist industry keeping their fingers crossed for fine weather. From its introduction in 1871, this bank holiday used to be known as Whit Monday, linked to the religious feast of Whitsun or Pentecost, a date that varies each year. But in 1971, the Banking and Financial Dealings Act renamed the day Spring Bank Holiday. The early May bank holiday was introduced relatively recently in 1978 by Michael Foot, the then Labour Employment Secretary. Some people objected to the idea, as it was linked to the Socialist International Workers' Day, introduced in 1891 as an opportunity for industrial agitation. And why are they called bank holidays? The original idea was a day off for banking workers, so, of course, if banks were closed, business and commerce also needed to have a day off. Often, nowadays, we just refer to these days as public holidays. In the days when society was based much more on agriculture and farming, May was seen as the end of the cold winter months. Crops, trees and flowers would begin to flourish again. Traditionally, the 1st of May was a day of celebrations, when villagers would decorate a maypole and people would join in singing and dancing. As long ago as Roman times, the beginning of May was celebrated between the 28th of April and the 3rd of May, with the festival of Flora, which honoured the goddess of flowers, fertility and spring. One thing that can't be regulated, as we all know, is the weather. This year we've experienced some extreme variations in the weather, from gloriously warm earlier in the month to unseasonably cold in the middle weeks, and now it looks as if we might be heading towards a summery bank holiday weekend. Recently I heard of an interesting legend concerning the midweek of May, during which, traditionally, three saints' days were marked. These were St. Mamertus on the 11th, St. Pancras, yes, presumably he of the station in London, on the 12th, and St. Servatius on the 13th of May. Collectively, these were known as the Frost or Ice Saints, and tradition had it that those 3 days would be particularly cold. As a result, people were advised not to plant out seedlings until after the middle of May, and were still warned that frosts can occur until later in the month. It's interesting to reflect on how religion had so much influence on many aspects of daily life in the past. Finally, there's the old saying, "Ne'er cast a clout till May is out." A clout was an old word for an item of clothing, and it's thought that May refers not to the month, but to the hawthorn or may blossom. So the advice was not to put away your warm clothes until the hawthorn trees were covered with blossom. The blossom came early this year, so I, for one, have been glad that I didn't put away my coat and gloves too soon.
Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Those days of soda and pretzels and beer. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Dust off the sun and moon and sing a song of cheer. Just fill your basket full of sandwiches and wieners. Then lock the house up, now you're set. And on the beach you'll see the girls in their bikinis. As cute as ever, but they never get them wet. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Those days of soda and pretzels and beer. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. You'll wish that summer could always be here. Soda and pretzels and beer. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Dust off the sun and moon and sing a song of cheer. Don't have to tell a girl and fella about a driving or some romantic movie scene. Why, from the moment that those lovers start arriving, you'll see more kissing in the cars than on the screen. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Those days of soda and pretzels and beer. Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. You'll wish that summer could always be. That summer could always be here. You wish that summer could always be here.
Now I'm going to refer to my ever faithful Susie Dent book that I've been enjoying using this year. 26th of May, and Susie's word of the day is Cockney. And it goes like this. The beautiful church of St. Mary Le Bow is an oasis in Cheapside within the City of London. Founded in around 1080 as the London headquarters for the Archbishop of Canterbury, its history is as formidable as its architecture. Devastated by the Great Fire of London in 1666, it was rebuilt by Sir Christopher Wren, only to be destroyed once more in this month in 1941 by German bombs during the Blitz, and it was rebuilt and reconsecrated in 1964. For all its majesty, it is perhaps the bells of the church that have settled most firmly in the imagination, though. For a true Cockney is one who, it is famously said, was born within their sound, which is actually further than you might think. One study from 2000 estimated that there were audible 6 miles to the east, 5 to the north, 3 to the south, and 4 to the west. Now, that's a very big area of London, which covers Bethnal Green, Whitechapel, Spitalfields, Stepney, Limehouse, Millwall, Shoreditch, Bow and Mile End, as well as Bermondsey, which is south of the Thames. The word Cockney has for centuries resisted any simple etymology. The first record discovered to date is from 1362, when it clearly meant a cock's egg, a physical impossibility, and hence became a byword for a rotten or defective one. But Chaucer used it in a different way, to mean a cockered or spoilt child, and by extension a weak or overindulged man. And it seems that Cockney was consequently picked up by chippy countrymen as an insult for any mollycoddled townsfolk who had no clue about the hardships of the countryside. A bit of a revenge, perhaps, for the disparagements thrown the other way by the town dwellers such as bumpkin or yokel. Eventually, Cockney was applied not to just a Londoner, but specifically those born near St Mary-le-Bow, until it embraced their local dialect too. Shakespeare was said to have been a speaker of it, though his Cockneyisms are in the form of pronunciation rather than vocabulary. But if there is a single expectation of what the world sees as typically Cockney, it's rhyming slang, a code that may have begun as a tribal banter amongst early 19th century costermongers. Like all slang, it was meant to baffle outsiders, including the authorities. The original versions often relied on the omission of the rhyming element, whether it was Barnet, meaning Barnet Fair or Hare in the 1850s, or Sweeney Todd, the Flying Squad, a century later. Rhyming slang has survived, but inevitably it has changed. The now known as Mockney relies on riffs of well-known names, such as poor old DJ Pete Tong, who is now a synonym for everything going wrong. Social implications have almost vanished as the patois is picked up by millennials who enjoy the wordplay. Meanwhile, multi-ethnic London English has also emerged, a dialect that reflects the city's multicultural makeup, blending terms from slang, Caribbean and American rap, as well as London's own Cockney. Whatever its future, apples and pears, stairs, not having a Scooby, Scooby-Doo, Clue, and going out for a Ruby, Ruby Murray, Curry, are still very much part of the British lexicon, and the idea, if not the reality, of the born and bred Cockney will remain on London's tourist map to be the linguistic equivalent of Routemaster buses and black cabs.
Chim, chiminy, chim, chiminy, chim, chim, cheree. A sweep is as lucky can be. Chim, chiminy, chim, chiminy, chim, chim, cheroo. Good luck, we're above when I shake hands with you. Or blow me a kiss, and that's lucky too. Now as the ladder of life has been strung, you might think a sweep's on the bottom most rung. Though I spends me time in the ashes and smoke, in this all wide world there's no happier bloke. Chim chiminy, chim chiminy, chim chim cheree. A sweep is as lucky can be. Chim chiminy, chim chiminy, chim chim cheree. Good luck, we're above when I shake hands with you. Chim chiminy, chim chiminy, chim chim cheree. A sweep is as lucky can be. Chim chiminy, chim chiminy, chim chim cheree. Good luck, we're above when I shake hands with you. I choose me bristles with pride, yes I do. A broom for the shaft and a brush for the flue. Up where the smoke is all billowed and curled, between pavement and stars is the chimney sweep world. When there's hardly no day, nor hardly no night, there's things off in shadow and off way in light. On the rooftops of London, what a sight.
Chim chiminy, chim chiminy, chim chim chiree. When you're with a sweep, you're in glad company.
Nowhere is there a more happier crew than them what sings chim chim chiree, chim chiroo. Chim chiminy, chim chim chiree, chim chiroo.
Well, that's it for this week. Grapevine is copyright 2026 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. Next week, your newsreaders will be Desney and Nevia. So, we look forward to your company for more of your local news. But, in the meantime, here's hoping that you stay safe and well. Enjoy the good weather, hopefully. So, from all your friends at Grapevine, have a good week and it's bye for now.